Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. It's our Friday Media Roundtable, the day we speak with a panel of reporters about coverage of the week's news. And on today's show, there's a lot to cover. On Sunday, the first coup d'etat in Central America in more than a century took place in Honduras. It was led by a graduate of the U.S. Army's School of the Americas, a military facility that's trained some of Latin America's worst human rights abusers. And as the Obama administration pulled back U.S. forces in Iraq, it increased troop levels in Afghanistan. A force of about 4,000, which arrived a few weeks ago, poured into three towns in the Helmand province. Today's front page story, written by Carlotta Gall in the New York Times, is called Marines Land in Cauldron of Afghan Resentment. In the piece, she quotes a number of villagers who say there are more people siding with the Taliban than foreign occupiers. And we'll talk about coverage of Afghanistan on today's show. And earlier this week, Israeli forces boarded a ship trying to carry aid to the Gaza Strip in defiance of Israel's blockade. The 20 passengers include U.S. Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney and Nobel Prize winner Mairead Maguire from Ireland. And on the domestic front, we'll discuss coverage of health care and the fight for gay rights, the 40th anniversary of Stonewall. On today's show, we are joined by Alan Moss. He's a staff writer for The Socialist Worker, the weekly paper published by the International Socialist Organization. Alan is in town for this weekend's Socialism 2009 conference at the Women's Building here in San Francisco. And Alan joins us in studio. Hi, Alan. Hi. Welcome to the show.
How you doing?
David Barsamian is also in town for the conference. David is host and director of Alternative Radio, heard on KALW Mondays at 1 o'clock. And David has actually been traveling around the country talking about the overall health of the media. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Nice to be here.
Nice to have you. We are also joined by Matthew Bajeko. Matthew is staff writer with the Bay Area Reporter, San Francisco's oldest and largest local newspaper of record, serving the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender communities. Hi, Matthew. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Well, as we always do, we like to start off on a positive note and talk about a piece of reporting that was done well this week. So what did you see? And if you can be specific, that would be great. Matthew, let's start with you.
Well, what I brought in today was... you know, Stonewall, the 40th anniversary happened on Sunday when a lot of major cities across the country have their gay pride parades. What I found interesting was that AARP.org covered Stonewall and had a pretty extensive package on it. And, I mean, who knew that the country's, you know, lobbyist group for senior citizens, one, cared about gay rights, and two, had a radio station, a TV station online. A friend of mine who works with, I know through the National Lesbian and Gay Journal Association, actually helped put together this package. If you go to their website, to AARP.org under Make a Difference, you click on Issues and Advocacy, and then you'll find all these really interesting little pieces about Stonewall. And I was just blown away by it, and I thought they did a great job.
So were they mostly human rights stories?
It was, there's video on there of the old raid. There's stories of the people who were there. There's little snippets with people, you know, famous LGBT people talking about what it meant for them. There's also links to SAGE, which is a group that works with older LGBT people in New York City. So it's just a really comprehensive package of things. And, you know, if Michael Jackson hadn't died, you probably would have seen more about Stonewall in the mainstream media. So,
all right. Thank you for that. We'll put a link after the website. Alan Moss, what about you? What did you see this week?
I'd have to pick an article by Andrew Coburn, who is an investigative journalist and has been writing for years in many, many different magazines. He had an article that appeared on Counterpunch, which was called The Wall Street White House. And it basically documents and details the number of figures that have gone straight from the boardrooms on Wall Street to the corridors of power in the White House, one after another. We all knew about Tim Geithner being the protege of Robert Rubin, the former head of Citigroup, and before that, the Clinton administration Treasury Secretary. But it's you know, basically the Obama White House is being staffed right down the line in its economics departments by a series of different people straight out of Wall Street.
Yeah, what stood out for you?
I thought it was just a documentation of the group of people who went from running the different departments of Citigroup that lost so much money and put Citigroup and the whole economy into a disastrous situation are now walking into the Treasury Department in the same places that are going to be working on the bailout, various forms of regulating, you know, Wall Street that are being discussed or not being discussed right now. So I thought it was really enlightening in that way of seeing the way in which those characters are taking their place.
So focusing on the revolving door,
right,
as it's called. So that's kudos to Andrew Coburn over at Counterpunch for Wall Street White House. And we will put that up on our website after the show. David, what about you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
I really liked Jeremy Scahill's report on his site called Rebel Reports on what's going on in Iraq today, where, you know, people are celebrating the newly gained sovereignty of the Iraqi state. And Scahill, I think, points out with great, you know, conviction and documentation that's kind of smoke and mirrors game going on, and that the residual forces that will remain in Iraq, that is American forces, will be combat brigades. There is no such thing as a kind of pacifist brigade or unit in the U.S. military, particularly when it's occupying a foreign country. So Scahill does a really good job also of taking the liberal left to task. That would be kind of the move-on crowd, as it were, who he describes as having almost cult-like adoration for Obama, and in that cult-like adoration, suspending critical thinking, which is still very, very crucial, you know, in this area as occupations are moving from Iraq to Afghanistan, but remaining in Iraq. And then the whole issue of, you know, oil being now sold off, and you know, the big companies moving in and getting those oil fields contracts.
Right, and we did a show about Iraq. We had four Iraqis on the show. We actually connected to Baghdad yesterday, and that is documented or archived, I should say, at yourcallradio.org. So, David, since you brought up Iraq, what is going to happen now that here I'm looking at the New York Times front page story, Afghanistan. Now that so many troops are going into Afghanistan, and there's a lot of attention there, what happens to coverage of Iraq?
It will be deep sixed, essentially. And Afghanistan becomes the new main screen for the imperial media, covering up the incredible expansion of the war and occupation in Afghanistan. And also mirroring some very dangerous trends which go back to the Vietnam War. For example, General Maxwell Taylor was appointed ambassador to Saigon by Johnson in 64. That signaled the ratcheting up of militarization of the policy in Southeast Asia. We find the same thing here with another general being appointed by Obama as the ambassador to Kabul, Eikenberry, someone, as far as I know, has no language skills, no cultural sensitivity. He is a professional military soldier. Then you've got McChrystal, who, you know, because of his earlier service in Afghanistan, was involved in the cover-up of the Pat Tillman affair. Then he goes to Iraq and is in charge of essentially a death squad, a unit, a special forces unit that Cy Hirsch and others have talked about that carried out extrajudicial assassinations of so-called militants or terrorists. We'll never know who they were, no evidence presented, and that kind of thing. So Obama is, I think, on a very dangerous course, and this marks a major expansion of the war in Afghanistan. And as Carlotta Gal, I think, rightly says, Afghans resent being occupied. Isn't that a surprise?
And that's the front page story of the New York Times is by Carlotta Gall. She's actually been there with a few breaks, obviously, since the invasion. The piece is called Marines, Land, and Cauldron of Afghan Resentment. And I'd like to give out the phone number. What we'll do today is talk about coverage of Afghanistan. Also, David was recently in Pakistan. We'll talk about that. And then we'll move on to Honduras just briefly. Sandeep will actually be doing a show about Honduras on Wednesday. We'll talk about the Free Gaza boat. And then later in the show, we'll talk about coverage of Stonewall and briefly healthcare. So you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. What did you make of the coverage about all of these very important things happening? When you see things happening, whether it's Gaza, Iran, Iraq, tomorrow it might be another country, how do you really analyze what's happening? How do you sift through this information to come up with your own conclusion? 866-798-8255. You can also email us at feedback at yourcallradio.com. www.stonewallinternational.org. So before we dive in and talk about what's going on the ground, David, do you know in terms of what is the status of the media in Afghanistan? Will we see Western journalists now flocking to Kabul? Will they be able to leave Kabul to go out into the villages?
Well, we know already, for example, ABC News was touting an embedded journalist that was featured last night on Gibson's World News on ABC.
So they're embedded just like they were in Iraq.
Precisely. They can't move around on their own. They don't have the language skills. They don't have, any of the knowledge that would be really required. I mean, there have been a few people that have gotten in there, like Christian Parenti some time ago, who reported in The Nation about his visit. Then also you had a very good reporter at NYU, who's now at the NYU Journalism School, Nir Rosen, reporting on the Taliban. These were a few instances where we got firsthand reporting from behind or inside the front lines.
But as we saw with the New York Times reporter that was just released by the Taliban, I mean, it's really dangerous over there. So it's almost near impossible. If you're going to go over there as a journalist to not be embedded with the military, you're really putting your life at risk. And, we would never have known that this New York Times journalist had even been being kept, because they kept the story hidden as much as possible. And that's finally coming out with these, Wikipedia was involved in censoring that story. And they were able to escape somehow. If they hadn't escaped, they'd probably still be there, and we would have no idea.
So you're talking about David Rode. Well, and there's a piece in the New York Times today, U.S. soldier may be held by Taliban, and the New York Times says military officials contacted by the Times say that they did not believe that writing about the kidnapping would increase the danger to the soldier, including any of the details. At the military's request, the Times agreed that it would withhold publishing the soldier's name if reporters learned it. The Times, along with other news organizations, withheld news of the kidnapping of one of its reporters, David Rode, and two Afghan colleagues, out of concern that publicity in that case would endanger them.
One of the things you find in reporting on Afghanistan, which is totally unnuanced in general, is that the Taliban are presented as a monolithic bloc. And all information that I've been able to gather, and from reports as well, is that there are multiple Taliban. Some of them are criminal gangs calling themselves Taliban. Others are engaged in drug trafficking. There is multiple Talibans. There's also the Taliban in Pakistan, which is also Pashtun, which is the main ethnic group in bordering that particular area. So that I think needs to be pointed out.
Well, and that's Carlotta Gall has this in her piece. She says Fazel Muhammad, a member of the district council of Panjwawi, an area west of Kandahar, said he knew people who were laying mines for the Taliban in order to feed their families. He estimated that 80% of insurgents were local people driven to fight out of poverty and despair. Offered another way out, only 2% would support the Taliban.
Right.
So this is an important, very important piece of this story, because you've got the word enemy coming back into the media. Who's the enemy? Who's the hero? And what is the point of the military? What are they doing there? Well, there's a story on top of Carlotta Gall's today. In tactical shift, troops will hold Afghan ground after clearing it. And this is basically about what the military plans to do, shooting the Taliban.
Afghans left
and
to their...
Yeah. We're going to take just a quick break. If you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also drop us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. We'll be back after this.
Your Call Friday Media Roundtable, now being rebroadcast on KALW at 5 p.m. Left, right, and center and counterspin, previously heard in the 5 o'clock hour, are now heard at 7 o'clock, immediately following Fresh Air.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our daily newsletter to find out what's coming up. Monday, we'll be declaring our independence from consumerism by replaying our interview with Dale Dougherty, editor and publisher of Make Magazine, and Matthew Crawford, author of Shopwork as Soulcraft. And then on Tuesday, as all of you know, California is facing devastating, devastating budget cuts. So we'll talk about how nonprofit providers of California's safety net are surviving the drop in state funding, memberships, foundation support, and then also the increased demand for services. Wednesday, Sandeep will be hosting a show about what happened in Honduras. And if you have a show idea for us or an overall comment, you can drop us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today is our Friday Media Roundtable. Every Friday, we speak with a panel of reporters about coverage of the week's news. Today, we are joined by Matthew Bajeko, staff writer for the Bay Area Reporter, San Francisco's oldest and largest local newspaper of record serving the LGBT community. We're also joined by Alan Moss, staff writer with The Socialist Worker, the weekly paper published by the International Socialist Organization. Alan is in town for this weekend's Socialism 2009 conference at the Women's Building. You can still register. We're also joined by David Barsamian, host and director of Alternative Radio, heard on KALW Mondays at 1 p.m. And I also wanted to let you know that Alan, David, and I, and John Pilger will be on a panel tomorrow night talking about the future of media at 7 o'clock, Saturday night at 7 o'clock. And if you'd like to join us, it's 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. We have full lines, but before the break, David, you were talking about the importance of giving the full story, not only quoting villagers like Carlotta Gall did today, but also really talking about, you know, who is the, quote, enemy? Who is the Taliban, for example?
The Taliban consists almost exclusively of Pashtuns, the largest single ethnic group in Afghanistan, and also they occupy a great part of Northwest Frontier Province and the so-called tribal areas of Pakistan. And the Taliban are driven by nationalism. It's, you know, to just reduce them to drug traffickers and criminal gangs, I think, really misses the point. They are interested in some kind of settlement along the border that would reverse a British colonial decision made in the 1890s to divide the Pashtun people, to punish them for their resistance to British invasions of Afghanistan. So there's a certain history here that's largely glossed over. And for Washington to think that they can engineer Pashtun nationalism and Afghanistan to suit their particular vision of what Afghanistan should be like, I think is going to come to a very bad outcome.
Well, we have a call in Afghanistan. Let's hear from Bill in San Francisco. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the show.
Hello. That's me, I assume. The article I'd like to recommend is in this week's Rolling Stone about by Matt Taibbi about Goldman Sachs. It's like a 12-page piece that basically shows the central role that they've played in a lot of the economic financial disasters in the United States in the last 30 years. Just it's an incredible piece, so I strongly recommend people picking up this week's Rolling Stone to read it. And the other thing I'd like to say, I kind of don't think David's being consistent with the Taliban. On one side, he's saying they're not all the same people. But then on the other side, he's saying, you know, they are. What I've read is these guys are, the leaderships are incredibly brutal. They mistreat women, and it's just a complete power game they're playing. And the same argument he's using, you could say the same thing with Germany in the 1930s. Germany didn't want to be taken over by anybody, you know. They would want to control their own land too. The point is, these guys are monsters, and they need to be taken out. So, this notion of being light on them, I think, is absurd. But anyway, thanks.
All right, thanks for the call, Bill.
Bye.
David? Well, monsters needed to be taken out. No one is saying that the Taliban are an ideal political or social formation. You didn't hear me say that. They are a nationalist group resisting occupation, and they have a history of resisting British intervention, Soviet intervention. After all, some of these were our boys. You know, Reagan called them freedom fighters in the 1980s when he hosted them in the White House. Many of them are homicidal maniacs. And, you know, engage in brutal practices. Yes, you know, these kinds of organizations are not pretty. They're not, you know, Mother Teresa. These are, in fact, resistance to foreign occupation formations. And as long as the Americans are there, that's the provocation that's going to unite them and provoke more and more resistance.
What I found fascinating lately is that, you know, during the campaign, we heard about how the mainstream media was just swooning over Obama, and you know they were pretty much bought, sold, and delivered to his campaign, and it's just, you know, they're questioning everything. I mean, I've seen stories this week in several publications about how Obama's really just Bush 2, you know, and like he hasn't really changed any of his policies, especially over in Afghanistan, with the economics. I mean, it's just really repackaged, resold using different words or phrases to the media, but the media has been like raising all of these questions lately, and I've been glad to see it.
Well, right, and he's making a concerted effort not to use the word surge, but the media is still using that word surge.
Absolutely.
And you wanted to jump in, Ellen.
Yeah, I wanted to say that I think that it's important to understand the base that the Taliban is drawing on that is not, you know, dedicated to Taliban ideology per se, but it's being driven by the brutality of the occupation. The fact that the United States' key military strategy has been the use of air power in totally indiscriminate ways, you know, and then the attempt by various Pentagon officials to try to blame these bombings when they go wrong on the Taliban is only creating more and more anger, which I think is what's driving, you know, support for the Taliban. That's really where it's at. The Taliban was a highly unpopular regime when it was in power, and the United States, through the brutality of its occupation, has managed to rehabilitate its image in the minds of Afghanis, which is an incredible thing when you think about it, an incredible example of the reverse Midas touch. You know.
Well, and speaking of Afghanis, again, Carlotta's piece quotes people. So let's hear from people in Afghanistan. Abdul Qadir Narazi, head of the Afghan Independent Human Rights Commission, says, quote, now there are more people siding with the Taliban than with the government. Quote, people are hostages of the Taliban, but they look at the coalition also as the enemy because they have not seen anything good from them in 7 or 8 years.
See, I think that's so important, too, that someone is getting that story, because that is not what you really read in most of the mainstream media. I mean, we've interviewed a reporter called Anand Gopal, who works for the Christian Science Monitor at socialistworker.org, and I highly recommend his stuff, because you read something completely different from what you get in the press releases, you know, as you do in the article you referenced in the New York Times today.
Or at the military briefings.
Right, exactly. Right. Because you're actually talking to people who have gotten out from somehow, you know, under very difficult circumstances, it's true, but have gotten out from somehow, you know, beyond the umbrella of the U.S. force and the U.S. Maintenance of the story that they want.
So, Alan, let me ask you. I mean, is this foreign policy basically old wine in new bottles?
I think that there is a lot to be said about that. You know, with the situation in Afghanistan itself. I mean, you see a number of the same generals who are putting forward the policies under Bush, you know, are being put forward under the new administration to take charge, and really a strategy that was put forward in Iraq being basically superimposed on Afghanistan in completely different circumstances, terrain and everything else, is being resurrected from the Bush administration and brought into place in Afghanistan. So on the question of foreign policy, there really is a lot of a lot more continuity than maybe people expected when they voted for Barack Obama in November.
And last question on Afghanistan, unless we have other callers who'd like to talk about Afghanistan. David, do you think that reporters covering Iraq who might be going to Afghanistan will learn anything in terms of their questioning, skepticism? Some of the pieces I read said that, you know, the military is afraid that it'll make the same mistakes that it made in Iraq.
It's hard to say, you know, what motivates reporters and what drives them to, you know, really get some dirt under their fingernails. But I think without the language skills and without the independence to move around freely, and it's, you know, I was in the border area in Pakistan, you know, fairly recently, and I was interested in going into Afghanistan, and I simply didn't have enough cash. Mm. I mean, the amount of money that's required for security, for drivers, for, you know, renting a vehicle is tremendous. And so only the New York Times and a few other organizations can really afford to station people there and then, you know, to have them going around as Gal has been doing for quite some time. So it's not clear whether there's going to be better reporting from Afghanistan. I think, you know, what really needs to be examined is the U.S. foreign policy in West Asia and South Asia. What are its goals? And is it, you know, is it some kind of an imperial expansion? Is it really fighting terrorism, which is now renamed? It's no longer called the War on Terrorism. It's called something with Operation Overseas Contingency Operations. What does that mean?
The War on Terror.
If you're just joining us, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. Today we're joined by David Barsamian, host and director of Alternative Radio, heard on KALW Mondays at 1, Alan Moss, staff writer with The Socialist Worker, and Matthew Bajeko, staff writer for The Bay Area Reporter. We have full lines, so let's go to our next call, Bill in Palo Alto. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for a good show again.
Thank you.
I just like to ask, how come everything seems to revolve around either the New York Times or the alternative media? People in the Bay Area get the Koran, the San Jose Mercury, the Oakland Tribune, but everybody I know, this isn't only just left wingers, depends mainly on the New York Times. Why don't these stories appear, or even these subjects? Brought up in what, you know, newspapers that claim to be the main newspapers of the Bay Area. And I think the same thing is true probably all over America.
Do you subscribe to the Chronicle?
No. But I buy the New York Times almost every day, even if it's not $2.
Then you don't need to subscribe to the Chronicle because the Chronicle just reruns New York Times stories. That's why everybody talks about the New York Times or the Washington Post is because or the AP. I mean, if you read any of the Bay Area papers these days, they are hurting because of the economic problems at all of their newsrooms. They don't have the money to send a reporter to be on the ground pretty much almost anywhere anymore. Mm-hmm. So you're reading a lot. Like, I mean, I subscribe to the New York Times. I'll pay for that newspaper because I know every other newspaper in the country is running their stories, so might as well pay to get this coverage. Otherwise, Carlotta Gall, she wouldn't be over there. You know, we saw yesterday, the Washington Post is hurting for so much money that its publisher is willing to sell access to dinners at her house for $25,000 a seat.
Or $250,000.
And you'll get an extra dinner for that, you know? I mean, it's We're not going to see a lot of coverage as we did with Iraq in Afghanistan this year, just because the news budgets at these mainstream outlets are just decimated because of what's been happening with the economy right now.
And in terms of state issues, for example, Bill, there are so many great blogs like Calitix, for example, but that involves sifting through a lot of information, and you need time for that, and obviously an internet connection.
I mean, the same is going on with the LGBT media as well, and alternative papers. I mean, we're all hurting to pay for the coverage that we're used to doing. I mean, just this week in New York City, one of the biweekly gay paper there, the New York Blade, was shut down. They just weren't pulling in. The Pride for gay newspapers is the biggest moneymaker of the year, right? According to the New York Times, the New York Blade's Pride issue was 28 pages. I mean, that's just dismal. You know, no wonder they shut that down. Mm. And it's going on everywhere with every media outlet these days, you know?
Well, I'd only bring up one contradiction to that. Where I live, anyway, we had just had, actually, a new free tabloid. I think part of it, I talked to somebody over at the Stanford Daily about this recently, part of it is that the journalists are so stuck into being sort of the broadsheet, patrician, metropolitan, sort of traditional newspaper that they don't want to think outside the box. The tabloids, and they're free, but some of them, like the Daily Journal from San Mateo, has a lot of news in it, are doing very, very well. And the most successful newspaper in the UK recently, well, about 2 years ago, switched from the broadsheet form to the tabloid form. That's the Independent. And I think it's probably the only major metropolitan, well, it's not just metropolitan, but a newspaper in the world that's actually growing in circulation.
Caller, I hate to disappoint you, but the Independent is in severe financial crisis.
No, yeah.
Yeah, it's up for sale.
Mm.
That's the paper that Robert Fisk writes for, as well as Patrick Coburn,
right,
that Alan mentioned earlier.
Well, okay, but when they switched from broadsheet to tabloid form, their circulation went up dramatically.
Well, thanks so much for calling in, Bill. We did a show about California media. Maybe we should do a roundtable about local media. Thank you for that, Bill. Let's go next to Nancy in Berkeley. Hi, Nancy. Welcome to the show. Nancy, are you with us?
Yeah.
Hi.
Hi.
You're on the air. If you can turn down your radio, please.
Oh, sure. Hang on. Just a second. I got to turn down my radio. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good idea if you call in to please turn down your radio, because there's a slight delay.
Hi.
Hi there.
Okay. Two things. I don't know which gentleman said that he felt that the left was, you know, gaga over Obama. And, I consider myself the left, and I was never gaga over him. I knew he was, you know, moderate to right, and he certainly hasn't disappointed me. And I know there's plenty other people who feel the same way, so I think the left is probably more disappointed with Obama than other people. The other thing is that I read an article in yesterday's Chronicle, which gave me a completely different picture of what's going on in Honduras. It said that that the president had overstepped his constitutional rights, and that it wasn't really a coup; it was more of a constitutional, movement or something, that there's very little support for the president, and that they had every right to maybe not throw him out the way he did, but to take over the government. So now I'm completely confused.
I think we're getting a little bit of propaganda there. I mean, I think that...
Let me ask Nancy, do you know who wrote this piece? Was it an editorial? Or?
It was on the, the comment page.
Okay, so it was an editorial.
Yeah, I guess it was.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that
Alan,
after having been quite surprised by the coup taking place, I think that some of the conservative foreign policy establishment is starting to get its story together, which is that and the bottom line is that if Zelaya was so unpopular, why is it that despite a blackout on the media in Honduras after the coup started, and hundreds and thousands of people, according to press reports in the mainstream, indicated that there were people on the streets demanding his return and opposing the coup under very difficult conditions, because the Honduran military for years and years and decades has been a highly militarized and repressive one. So I mean, I think that there's a certain degree to which people on the right are trying to spin it that way, and it's a very simple reason why. Because Zelaya, though he was far from a radical, he belongs to the Liberal Party, which is one of the two mainstream parties of the elite of Honduras, has been moving closer and closer to Hugo Chavez, and that is the kiss of death in the view of the most right wing, and in fact in the view of the mainstream of the U.S. government. He was, in particular, the idea that he's overstepped his bounds is based on the idea that he's followed on the path that Chavez and Evo Morales of Bolivia have done, which is to call constituent assemblies to rewrite constitutions. And that is really there was supposed to be a referendum on the day of the coup. There was supposed to be a non-binding referendum asking the public whether they thought this is a good idea. Rather than allow this to take place, the right wing, the elite, moved in Honduras. And that I think is the key question there. That's where the opposition to Zelaya came from.
You could add Rafael Correa of Ecuador to that list.
Right.
And I wanted to let you know, Nancy, that Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman has an op-ed in today's San Francisco Chronicle about the coup, so maybe you can...
Yeah, I haven't gotten that far with the Chronicle,
okay.
But definitely, yeah.
So maybe you can compare the two, and then be sure to listen on Wednesday. Sandeep will be hosting a show about Honduras,
okay.
And we'll bring up all right. of these questions and really kind of dive down beneath the headlines.
Thank you,
Nancy.
Once again, with the coverage of how important it is to have journalists on the ground where the story is happening... Initially, when that story broke, a lot of the journalists weren't even in Honduras. They were reporting from other countries. And so it wasn't until the New York Times reporters actually got in there that I finally saw a story the other day where they talked to the generals and were like, well, actually, no, it wasn't a coup because we went to the courts and the reporter was sitting in the office describing how this general was waving this court document in front of him. And, it painted a very different picture of what, President Obama and all these other leaders have been saying in regards to what happened. So it's just, once again, sometimes it takes a while when a story breaks if you don't have the people there to get them in there. And when you're dealing with a country that, obviously leadership is in question, it's not that easy to get into the country.
And
right?
then if you just fly in, you have to take a crash course on Honduran politics.
Right.
And here I think it was actually really important in trying to follow what was taking place on Sunday and write about it for Monday morning. Mm-hmm. It was very valuable to not pay attention to the mainstream media, which wasn't there, as you say, but actually to see the blogs and things that were being put out by people in the region, but who are watching Spanish language television in the region and were able to convey that, the things that were taking place there. So in the mainstream media, you kept reading these reports about clashing protesters, pro Zelaya and opposition to Zelaya, and seeing absolutely none of that within the blogs or anything like that. So you have to, I think that's an example where the independent media, actually served an incredibly useful purpose in getting out the real story of what was taking place.
And we're seeing this happen all over the world now. That's the beauty of the internet, is that you're no longer. The news is no longer a stranglehold by the mainstream media, the corporate media. It's like if you don't want to, you don't have to read them anymore. I mean, you don't. You can go online and you can Google. You can find news outlets from the country, from nearby. People tweeting. I mean, it's just such a different experience of reading news stories. And we saw it happen in Iran when. That country was going through its presidential election. It's just a very different world we live in. And the variety of news sources, it's just you have to take the time to find them. You're not going to pick them up in the Chronicle or the New York Times. It's like if you only read that one paper every day, then, your view of a story is definitely going to be skewed.
All right, let's take another call from Elizabeth in Oakland. Hi, Elizabeth. Thanks for holding.
Hi. I wanted to say I wanted to thank... Your Call Radio for having a great show on the Stonewall Rebellion, including having Tommy Avakolameka on and Kate Raphael talk about two people who are actually local queer radical activists who, unfortunately, you won't read in the Bay Area Reporter.
Kate will have an op-ed in our paper next week, and we cover Kate and Tommy all the time.
Yeah, well, generally speaking, Tommy's in the Beyond Cron. And, looking at the, I'm just looking at the Bay Area Reporter of this week. I think that the Bay Area Reporter has really failed to be in the spirit of Stonewall at all, because there is very little radical queer content in there. And
our Stonewall coverage was last week.
What I have to say, this comes up constantly around gay marriage, which even a report out of Hunter College has shown is not even in the top five issues for gay people, and that over 3,000 people have signed on beyondmarriage.org, including many academics, including Judith Butler and others, that gay marriage is not the issue that gay people should be pressing for, that gay marriage essentially is creating second-class citizens of people who are not married, like single queers, and is also falling into the pro-marriage right-wing movement, and basically benefits people who have assets, and that we don't even have an economic discrimination bill, and that unfortunately we don't have a radical queer press, and that I would really like to thank you, Rose, for having on Tommy and Kate and bringing up this issue around gay marriage, because unfortunately it doesn't get the dialogue it needs in even in the socialist conference that's coming up this very evening, where there's a whole entire panel on Prop 8, but nobody to discuss a critique of Prop 8, which, as we know, partly failed because, once again, the gay community has failed to make coalitions with anybody else outside of their own community, although they're trying to rectify that now in hindsight. Interestingly, this is the same thing that happened in, this has been happening forever, since the Briggs Initiative. I mean, this has been going on forever, but this is certainly not what Stonewall was about.
Well,
Stonewall,
Elizabeth,
not about single issue.
Thank you so much for calling. You brought up a number of points. So let's kind of try to keep it to media coverage. What about Elizabeth's complaint that she doesn't hear enough radical voices in the Bay Area Reporter?
Well, I totally disagree, and it sounds like she doesn't read our paper every week, because she would have seen Tommy and Stonewall coverage in last week's paper. We talk to Tommy all the time. We talk with people who don't believe in gay marriage all the time. We run editorials from them. One of the main people from Berkeley, Leland Trayman, we include him a lot because he's one of the only people who's really pushing this about how, you know, we shouldn't be just focusing on gay marriage. But we don't talk just about gay marriage in our paper either. I mean, we've been talking about ENDA ad nauseum for years. We've been talking about hate crimes. We've been talking about economic issues. I mean, just, you know, this week in our Pride coverage, that story ended up focusing a lot on the radical queers who blockaded the mayor in the Pride parade over the budget cuts and had a die-in. So it sounds like she doesn't really read our paper as often as maybe she should, and she would see these voices, because we try to expand and talk to as many people as we can. But with a limited budget these days, we don't have as much news hole to get as many stories as we would love to get in there every week.
Speaking for socialistworker.org, I mean, I think that the thing that I see as the most significant thing is the outburst and explosion of people coming into the streets immediately after Prop 8 was passed, right? That mobilization drew in large numbers of new people who may have come around the issue specifically around question of marriage equality, but all sorts of things are being raised. And I think it's been an incredibly valuable period of months for not just, you know, the LGBT movement, but for the whole left to understand the issues that are coming up that are not just about marriage equality, which I do think goes far beyond the question purely of marriage, but goes to a question of class and economic rights. But also going beyond that, I think that questions like ENDA are coming up as a result of that and are being taken up. When we interview and have roundtables in socialistworker.org about, people who are coming, some of the people who will speak at the Socialism Conference tonight, in addition to Sherry Wolf, the author of Sexuality and Socialism, people like Kip Williams, who are part of One Struggle, One Fight here in the Bay Area, you know, talk about the way in which this is a movement that's developing that may have come to, come about as a result of the specific thing about Prop 8. But it's raising all sorts of bigger questions, which, you know, the National March on Washington this October, I'm looking forward to seeing that, because that's not just going to be about Prop 8 in California or gay marriage, marriage equality around the country. It's going to be about a whole set of other issues that I think are crucial and have been too long in the shadows.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Elizabeth. We don't have much time left, and I want to get as many callers as possible and then also talk about, Alan, you're trying to raise money to send a reporter to Gaza. We'll get to that also before the end of the show. Let's hear from Lawrence in Berkeley. Hi, Lawrence.
Yeah. Hi, Rose. Talk about the corporate mass media. They've been lying absolutely and in lockstep about Honduras. Because they say that the issue is about term limits, and of course that's not what it's about. It's about rewriting the Constitution completely with a constituent assembly. But what I don't get, I can't read it anywhere, is what are the constitutional issues? You know, you hear that Zelaya is pro-poor, is raising the minimum wage, and you hear that the Constitution is a reactionary instrument of the rich in Honduras. But what are the constitutional issues that he wanted to raise? Does anybody know that?
I'm getting some blank faces.
No, the key question was about the question of bringing together constituent assembly to take up a whole number of issues. One of the questions is term limits, and that was a part of part of the issue. But, you know, you have to remember that this is a constitution that was created in a death squad government. I mean, that's the truth of what Honduras has been for decades, especially in the 1980s when it was a staging area for the U.S. government's covert and not-so-covert war on communism, whether in the form of the Sandinista government or against rebel movements. It has been a constitution that has always been based around the interests of the elite, which is a tiny landed oligarchy and a pro-U.S. military. And so I think that those are the sort of questions. This is, again, coming from someone who was a creature of that establishment, of that elite, who is, as a result of the U.S. sort of losing credibility as a force, even in its own backyard, is I think, being pulled in other directions toward the alternative that's put forward around Chavez and Correa and Morales. So.
And the coup leader was a notorious graduate of the School of the Americas in Fort Benning.
Right. And Lawrence, thank you for the question. It's a great question. We will add it to our list for Wednesday's show on Honduras. So please be sure to tune in and also call in. Thank you, Lawrence. Next, let's go to Isa in Oakland. Hi, Isa. Welcome to the show. I'm sorry, Lisa. Lisa, are you with us?
Yes. Hi.
Hi there.
Lisa with Making Contact, a national radio series. And
Lisa.
I'm tempted to comment on the coverage of Honduras and also of radical queer coverage. But the reason I called was to point people towards blogger and journalist Dar Jamail and his Mideast dispatches. I know, Rose, you've had him on the program, and I thank you for that. And I really think he adds to the discussion and sort of extends the diet and the variety of media that we can access. So it's DarJamailIraq.com. And just wanted to remind people of Dar's reporting.
Okay, thank you so much, Lisa.
Oh, and I had another question for David, though.
Okay, just briefly. We're almost out of time.
Well, media within Afghanistan and Pakistan, because he's traveled so widely there, what sort of media diet are people there consuming?
Well, of course, there's the elite media. I can speak in some detail about Pakistan. The elite media is dominated by English language newspapers, radio, and TV. The masses of people read the Urdu newspapers, and there you get this incredible dichotomy because the Urdu press is very much opposed to the drone attacks, to U.S. intervention in Pakistan, to U.S. intervention and occupation in Afghanistan. So it's almost like two parallel universes going on. You have the English language media, which reaches a sliver of the population. Pakistan has some 200 million people, perhaps 10-15% have access to the English language media. And the Urdu language press is much more militant, much more, I would say, yes, some elements of it is Islamist and has sympathies with what the Taliban is trying to do in terms of ousting the U.S. from the region. Afghanistan, I haven't been inside the country in a long time, so I really can't speak to the media, but the level of illiteracy there is extremely high. So people are depending primarily on state-run radio and TV networks. That means the Karzai government out of Kabul, which, you know, the bad joke is that Karzai's government really, he's the mayor of Kabul and his writ doesn't extend beyond the capital city.
Thank you, Lisa. And you brought up Dar Jamail. We're actually having him on the show soon. He wrote a new book about dissent in the U.S. military. In fact, you can find an article today at Alternet. He quotes a number of troops saying that they will not deploy to Afghanistan. The occupation is immoral and unjust. That's a quote from Specialist Victor Augusto. So Dar will be on sometime later this month. Thank you for the call.
And he's actually at the Socialism Conference as well.
That's right.
He'll be there at 4 o'clock on Saturday, so you come for that and stick around to listen to Rose and David.
Yeah, we'll be on a panel tomorrow night at 7. So we're almost out of time, but I wanted to ask you, Alan, you are trying to raise money, the socialist worker is trying to raise money to send a reporter to Gaza.
Right. We have a reporter who is going to Gaza as part of the Viva Palestina convoy. It's going to be an aid convoy that will convene in Cairo and basically try to enter Gaza at the Rafah crossing point to bring humanitarian aid to the people who have suffered, you know, not only the debilitating siege, but the continuing effects of the Israeli assault earlier this year. Eric Reuter is our reporter, has been writing continually on this issue, and he's going to be the person who's going with the convoy. We've tried to see if we could get the support of our readers, because the independent media always needs that, the support of its readers to get anything done. So we've done that on our website right now.
And in terms of stories and media coverage, I mean, we only have 2 minutes, but thanks to my Facebook page, I found out there's a lot of news going on in Israel that I didn't hear about in the mainstream. Naomi Klein was just in Berlin launching her book, The Shock Doctrine. She's calling for a boycott of Israel. And the Yes Men are out with a new film. They were supposed to introduce it at the Jerusalem Film Festival, but they decided not to support the boycott. And then you've got the Free Gaza Boat. Human Rights Watch came out with a report about the assault on Gaza in December. What are your thoughts overall on coverage of Gaza? Do you think it's changing at all since the assault?
I think so. I think that you've had, especially in the independent media, that really things have opened up as a result of some of these convoys. On socialistworker.org, we've had a piece by Laura Durkee, one of our contributors, who wrote a brilliant piece after having gone on a Code Pink visit. I think that you are getting, because of the depth, the brutality of the assault, I think that people's eyes have opened up about what conditions really are like, and that's really given a boost to the coverage that's taking place.
And David, 30 seconds.
Well, the human rights situation in Gaza is appalling. It's the world's largest open-air prison. Efforts to break the blockade, like this ship, Code Pink convoys. George Galloway is leading a convoy very soon in the next couple of days to try and get into Gaza and to deliver some badly needed medicine and food, as well as construction material. Israel has a boycott, has limited the importation of cement into Gaza. That means none of the homes can be rebuilt. People are living in rubble.
And we'll have to leave it there. We also just got news that the boat is going to try to go back to Gaza, even though some of the people on the boat are still in prison. So we'll be following that. Alan Moss, staff writer with The Socialist Worker, Matthew Bajeko with Bay Area Reporter, and David Barsamian, host of Alternative Radio. Thank you all for joining us. And again, I'll be on a panel with Alan and David and John Pilger tomorrow night at 7 at the Women's Building. Thanks for listening. I'll be right back to let you know what's coming up on Monday. In a consumer culture, is making something or fixing it yourself a revolutionary act? On the next Your Call, we'll declare our independence from consumerism by replaying our interview with Dale Doherty, editor and publisher of Make Magazine, and Matthew Crawford, author of Shop Class as Soulcraft, an inquiry into the value of work. Will making and fixing more of our own stuff and honoring the people who do it bring us a healthier economy and happier lives? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. In a consumer, support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW and the friends of KALW. To listen to past shows, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find links there to the Your Call blog and podcast. Malihe Razazan is producer, Ben Temshin is senior producer, and Matt Martin is our executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor, and Kate Elston is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Debbie Kennedy is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.